This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. He was just 14 years old when he confessed to and was convicted of a quadruple murder in Detroit. But today, 23-year-old Devontae Sanford walks out of Ionia State Prison a free man. His conviction was vacated Tuesday by Wayne County Circuit Judge Brian Sullivan. The judge agreed with arguments that Sanford's case had all the hallmarks of a false confession. David Moran is a University of Michigan clinical professor of law, and he directs the Michigan Innocence Clinic. He was co-counsel in this case. David, thank you for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
What were the inconsistencies in Devontae's case?
First of all, you got to understand how Devontae came into this. The police responded to the scene of a quadruple murder on Detroit's east side, and they found several neighbors milling around, and among them was Devontae Sanford, a 14-year-old, 5'5" kid wearing his pajamas. And for reasons that we can't fathom, the detective in charge of the case decided that this kid somehow knew something, took him downtown, interrogated him without a parent or guardian present for hours, brought him back home, and then the next day took him back down to Detroit Police Headquarters again without a parent and guardian present, and again interrogated him for hours. So the story that eventually emerges, the so-called false confession, was full of facts that were simply wrong. So Devontae claimed that he and three other kids had committed this robbery and murdered all the occupants of the house. But the other three kids were all cleared within 72 hours. They all had rock-solid alibis. He said they each had a different kind of weapon. He named the four weapons they supposedly had. That didn't match the ballistics. In fact, there were only two perpetrators seen fleeing the house, and there were two types of bullets that were found at the scene that did not match up with the bullets that Devontae claimed. He said where they dumped the weapons afterwards, the police searched there, and no weapons were found there. He said they met up at a Coney Island restaurant to plan the robbery beforehand, but that Coney Island restaurant had been closed for months. So virtually everything in the confession was false. In fact, what we did later was we had Jim Tranum, who is a nationally known police expert. He was a former detective in D.C. who was actually famous because he extracted a false confession in the 1990s from a woman. And then years later, she was exonerated and he went back and looked at it. And so since then, he's become an expert in what makes a confession false, how the police should do interrogations. Mm-hmm. And so co-counsel here was the Center on Wrongful Convictions of Youth at Northwestern Law School, led by Megan Crane. They contacted Jim Tranum in D.C., and he analyzed Devontae's confession. And what he concluded was that every single fact that Devontae got right in the confession was something the police already knew. Every single fact that the police didn't already know, he got wrong. And that's the hallmark of a false confession. The only things you're getting right are what the police already know. In other words, the police are feeding you the facts. He also analyzed Vincent Smothers' confession, which came sometime later.
In fact, let's go to this. Vincent Smothers, who is a professional hitman, admitted to the killings.
That's
and he
right.
did it 8 years ago. Why did it take so long for this day to come for Devontae Sanford to go free?
And that's a great question for the Detroit police and the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office. So just 16 days after Devontae Sanford was sentenced to 39 to 82 years, Vincent Smothers was picked up on a contract killing. And he tells the police that the gig is up and he will confess to all of the contract killings he committed over the previous few years. They turn the cameras on and Smothers confesses in great and extremely accurate detail to 12, including the four on Runyon Street. And what they ended up doing was charging him only with the other eight. And then they gave him a deal to second-degree murder, even though they had him cold for first-degree murder. It gave him a deal to second-degree murder, which had the effect of preventing him from going to trial, because had he gone to trial, it almost certainly would have come out that he had confessed to Runyon Street as well.
And totally blown up what they had done.
That's right.
With Dante.
And his confession was extraordinarily accurate in every detail. Two perpetrators who fit the description of the perpetrators who were seen fleeing. He named his accomplice in the killing. He told the police where they would find one of the guns used in the killing, and they did, at a home associated with the accomplice. He said that the other gun would match some of the other, ballistically would match some of the other killings that he had committed, that he was confessing to, which it did. Everything fit together. And yet, the defense didn't find out about this for almost a year. The police and the prosecution kept it under wraps for nearly a year until the State Appellate Defender Office, which was representing Devontae at the time, finally found out about it.
As this has played itself out for all of these years, where is this resistance from the prosecutors coming from?
You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Kim Worthy will be holding a press conference tomorrow, and I think that's a question – for her. It's certainly not just a Detroit phenomenon. We find, and other Innocence Projects, Innocence Clinics around the country, in fact, even internationally, find that there is often great resistance to admitting that a mistake has been made. And even, frankly, wacky theories are advanced in order to try and explain away when the new evidence doesn't match the preconceived conviction. And so in this case, I know there was talk of that, well, maybe Vincent Smothers and his accomplice used Devante as an assistant, which was an idea that was just ridiculous to Vincent Smothers. I've met Vincent Smothers. We got a 26-page affidavit from him about the killings. And the idea that he and his adult accomplice would use a 5'5", 14-year-old kid to carry out a professional hit is just ridiculous. But it's the sort of cognitive dissonance that we see sometimes, is that the police and the prosecution just can't accept that they got it wrong. It's a human thing, and it's very difficult to accept that you got it wrong. And so they start spinning weird and wild theories as to how, well, maybe we still got it right after all. And I'm very thankful to Kim Worthy that faced with the Michigan State Police's reinvestigation, and that's what ultimately brought this case to a head, is we filed, the Center on Wrongful Convictions of Youth and the Michigan Innocence Clinic last April filed the motion for relief from judgment in Wayne Circuit Court. And as a result of that and the publicity surrounding that filing, the Michigan State Police got interested. Kim Worthy authorized a reinvestigation by the state police. That reinvestigation took over a year. But when it came out on May 20th, it was apparently, we haven't seen it yet, it was apparently devastating to the prosecution's case. And so Kim Worthy did the right thing and pulled the plug on it yesterday.
You do a lot of this kind of work around the country. David, put this case in context for us. How does Devante Sanford's case compare with other wrongful conviction cases you've worked on in the past?
Well, there are a lot of commonalities between this case and other cases around the country. There are now nearly 2,000 exonerations that are recorded on the National Registry of Exonerations at the University of Michigan Law School and Northwestern Law School. And many of the same causes of wrongful convictions that happen in the Devante Sanford case happen in hundreds of these other cases. So false confessions is a leading cause. In about 25% of all the exonerations so far, the defendant falsely confessed. Police misconduct is a common feature of wrongful convictions. In this case, apparently a police commander claimed that Devante, during one of the interrogation sessions, had drawn a very accurate map of the living room where the four people were killed. And in fact, eventually he admitted that Devante didn't draw that map and the police drew that map. So that's an example of police misconduct. The fact that they didn't turn over what Vincent Smothers was saying for nearly a year is an example of police misconduct. Terrible lawyering is a feature, especially in Michigan, but across the country, that leads to wrongful convictions. And Devante had a terrible lawyer in this case, a man who has been disciplined over and over again. His license is currently suspended for a B&E, but he's been disciplined or reprimanded, I believe, more than 20 times at this point.
And how is a 14-year-old kid going to know what kind of public defender has been appointed for him?
Right. Well, actually, his lawyer was retained.
He was retained. Okay.
He was retained by the family, but he never challenged the confession. I mean, the most obvious point to any competent attorney is that when a 14-year-old kid is taken in the middle of the night without his parents or his family or any guardian present and interrogated twice on two consecutive nights, 4 hours, emerging with a confession that is obviously false, does not match the facts, that is confession that should be suppressed. And there are constitutional grounds to suppress a confession like that. And he didn't even move to suppress it. The only other evidence against Devante at trial that had any significance was the surviving victim managed to crawl under a bed. So she couldn't see the perpetrators, but she heard the voice of one of the perpetrators. And she testified at trial that the voice of one of the perpetrators sounded like it could be Devante's voice. But Michigan law actually makes that sort of testimony inadmissible unless the victim or the witness has a prior familiarity with the voice. But again, the defense lawyer didn't move to suppress this unreliable, basically junk testimony that should never have come in the first place. So after hearing that testimony and hearing the confession of the officer, the confession of Devante through the testimony of the officer, the attorney told the family that it was hopeless and he should plead guilty. And so that's what Devante did. He pleaded guilty to 4 counts of second-degree murder midway through the trial instead of even finishing the trial, because the case was hopeless, which, in fact, it was, given the extremely substandard representation of the lawyer.
It certainly is a story that is startling to the public, which would like to think that the wheels of justice move in the right direction and do the right thing?
They do occasionally. In this case, the wheels of justice finally moved in the right direction, but Devante Sanford lost 9 years of his life from age 14 to 23. And if we all think about how important those years are in our development, Devante Sanford spent much of that time in solitary confinement in Michigan State prisons because he was a kid. And this is a complete and utter failure of the criminal justice system. And the fact that we got it right now makes me feel very good, but it doesn't undo the damage that was been done to Devante Sanford.
David Moran, University of Michigan, clinical professor of law with the Michigan Innocence Clinic. Thank you so much for being with us, David.
My pleasure.